right, time for another Google is Evil. DoNotToGod.com video presentation. Ugh. I have to talk to people. Ugh, humans. All right. I'm going to just play a Sam Harris, Neil deGrasse Tyson video on Are We Alone in the Universe? And just in the context of alone with what, you know. what kind of other morons are there? Moron meets moron, who cares? There's just nothing to base any of this crap on, and they have to just aggrandize every story to make a story, right? They have to just make some kind of silly, you know, conclusion. So it's sort of like that Carl Sagan movie, whatever it was, with the stupid contraption that, you know, enabled the person to travel or whatever to it's above light speed to get to some place or something and communicate with the aliens. And so, and she meets the alien, and it's just all a daydream, right? It's all just mushy talk, little baby talk conversation, nothing real. Just demonstrating. It's just, you know, they can't even make up a rational narrative. It always has to be a happily ever after fairy tale pile of crap. And yeah, so, but whatever, this is the human condition. So I just figured I'd play some of this. I don't know what the hell they're going to say. It was sort of sold as they were going to have a real conversation about, the title is Alone in the Universe, but apparently it's also sold as some sort of conversation about what the meaning of life is. And apparently they're not going to talk about that, but whatever. My mistake. So we'll just play some of this for the sake of, it doesn't, like I said, it's so easy to trigger me. There's so many points to make, and so many of them are made so badly, and just all based on bullshit premises. And Sam Harris is guilty of being just as dumb a robot as the rest of the moronic robots. I mean, just falls into the cliche, you know, horse shit. I mean, the having kids thing is just so stupid. I mean, it's such a reckless, dumb experiment. And especially when you are somebody already, you know, you're just setting your kids up for a kind of failure that's, you know, that ruins people, you know, that creates alcoholics and assholes because they grow up just being inferiors, obvious inferiors. You know, it's just not a good thing to do. Oh, it's just so stupid. I mean, it's such a void of you know, a lack of understanding. Why would he fall into that trap unless he's got some real holes in his capacity to understand? I'm tempted to play. He's got another video where he's doing his last update on the argument of free will. I mean, he makes very good arguments against free will, so. Just kind of funny that he doesn't put two and two together and figure out, well, if there's no free will, then we are just fucking robots. So why don't we just talk about how we're programmed? Anyway.
And now I bring you Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I think I've gotten past.
I am back once again with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Back again. Anyway. I could use a little more volume myself. Anyway, all right. Yeah, I just don't have any enthusiasm. This is not going to be good. Oh.
Yes.
You know what I will do? I'll predict that Neil deGrasse Tyson will basically argue both sides. He'll say, well, life's really impossible, but there's so many stars. Yeah.
Damn. I mean, you know, I love your show, and I never think of myself being on it. So that when I'm on it, it's like, ooh, what am I going to talk about? Because all of your guests and all of your conversations are, you know, anything that I do, just as a scientist and as a popularizer, you kick it up a notch and you just inject it into all of the most controversial things going on in society. And I'm just not that brave. Okay. So I feel like I don't, you know, I should not be on your show. I just feel that way sometimes.
Well, I hope not to confirm that hypothesis, but I will lead you to the edge of your courage, and you can pull me back.
Okay.
But it's great to hear your voice. And before we go all over the place here, I want to...
Oh, yeah. Well, before we get to something, you know, we'll just talk this crap. Thank you. Sorry, I didn't need any of that. I've been there and done all of that crap before. Can't you just do your little handshaking in private? Do you have to do it in public? And by handshaking, I mean, you know, sticking your tongue in each other's asses.
Just touch upon your book, because you have a new book out, which is...
Oh, yes, of course. We have to sell the new moronic book. His books are moronic. I mean, you know. Dummies books, you know. Cosmos for Dummies. Yeah, just believe whatever I tell you.
It's Cosmic Queries, Star Talk's Guide to Who We Are, How We Got Here, and Where We're Going. And let's start with the area of just pure scientific interest.
Fat and ugly? Yeah, where were we going? Yes, fat and ugly and stupid.
And then we can go to points of controversy or not as the hour unfolds. But this is really a gorgeous book. It's published by National Geographic, so it's really well illustrated. And in reading it, I confess I have not read all of it, but I've read...
Yeah. I just couldn't stand it. It was just so fucking juvenile and pathetic. I couldn't be at all interested.
A lot of it. And it just struck me immediately that this is the book you would want to hand to a smart, inquisitive, science-interested teenager.
Yes, it's a kiddie book. It'll pop up pictures and... So do start them off right with a little Noah's Ark and pop up. Tell our little stories about physics.
You know, like anywhere from, I don't know, 14 on up, it's just perfectly pitched to... Like a person's first book on science. Was that at all your intention in writing it?
Oh, fuck. I didn't know they would do this. I should have known they would do this, but I didn't know they would do this.
It was interesting you say that, because what I learned from my very first book, which was many, many moons ago, I wrote a book.
Yeah, you wrote a book telling us Pluto's not a planet, even though it's got fucking moons. But whatever.
And I said, well, if I'm going to write a book on science, I want to make sure everyone understands everything that's in it, right? And so my first book was a question and answer book on the universe, and I wrote it in a playful way. I had a pen name for Merlin, Dear Merlin, you know, how does the universe work? And Merlin would recall a conversation with Einstein. It was a fun, playful thing. And all the questions were asked by full-up adults. When the book came out, I found that when adults read it and they understood everything in it, they thought to themselves, well, this is clearly not for me. This is for someone younger. And I said, wow. So people are accustomed to when they encounter a science book, they expect some of it to sit above their head.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. So that's what he thinks. He thinks that's his conclusion, when his conclusion is, don't patronize me. I mean, can't you get to the subject? Blah, 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 blah. You know. Do you have to do all this fluffy crap? Does it have to be in everything? Does everything have to be covered with little fluffy pieces of lint? And little, you know, shit.
And so I said, oh, okay, so my next book, I'm going to have two chapters that's guaranteed to be above everybody's head, and no one thought about giving those to kids. But Cosmic Queries, I think, is a celebration of the deepest sources of curiosity that exist within us as humans.
Oh, so I'm sure your deepest curious thoughts are not my deepest curious thoughts. But whatever, as humans. Shit, humans.
And all of those cylinders, if I'm allowed to use an internal combustion engine reference, all of those cylinders are firing for all of us when we were younger, right? Every day is, oh, what is that? And there's a flower and a tree and a rock and why is this and why is that? And some of those questions get very deep, like how did it all get here? And why are we all here? And are we alone? How will it all end? And so that deeper category of question got elevated and put into this book. But the whole concept of Cosmic Queries is stoked monthly in our podcast, Star Talk. Star Talk, we interview celebrities and...
Whatever. You know, the whole external universe thing is just so uninteresting. I just don't know how people could find even a conversation about it. know, in the sense that it's just, yes, you can see it's little blobs of, you know, hydrogen being converted into helium. That produces light. It's very massive. Other crap gets caught up in the gravitation, blah, blah, blah. It's all been there, done that, been there, done that, been there, done that. They might as well call all the stars, been there, done that, been there, done that, been there, done that. I mean, there really isn't much going on.
I have a comedian who's a co-host, so it's very, they're a force of levity on a show where content might have their own force of gravity. Mm-hmm. And I dial those in so that we have a consistent product each time. But one of the more successful variants on that show is called Cosmic Queries, where our fan base just simply asks us questions. And we culled the deepest subset of those.
Yeah, we just redundantly answer the same fucking idiotic questions, and we just answer them completely contrary. So if I'm on one show, I say life is impossible. If I'm on another show, I say, gee, it's only carbon and some water. What the hell? Easy peasy.
And put them into this book. So for me, it's a celebration of what it is to be human and be on one side of knowing something and want to cross over into another side of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's...
Another side of enlightenment. It's enlightenment to get all gooey about it. Look at the pretty pictures.
Yeah. It serves the curiosity in us all. I think some adults, they've lost it. And so maybe it'll fan the embers and maybe ignite a flame once again, because you know it was there when you were younger. So I think that's why you were feeling that way about it, mm-hmm. because it makes you feel young again and wide-eyed.
So I guess they all had some point where they heard the story of evolution and that wasn't horrifying enough, right? That didn't tell you all you needed to know. Oh, it's a bug planet. I mean, that's sort of what happened to me, right? I mean, okay, ask the initial question. Hey, what am I doing here? How the hell is, what's going on? What am I, what, you know? And they give you this stupid, silly God answer, and you say, well, shit, I know that ain't the truth. And then you find out the truth, and it's basically just saying, oh, I'm just a well-equipped, you know, tank in a silly demolition derby. Oh, okay. How fascinating.
And thanks for noticing the National Geographic DNA in the book. It's a beautiful book. And we didn't stop at just science illustrations. There's art as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's art. Besides illustrations, there's art. Hmm. Really pretty colors. Pretty colors, pretty colors, pretty colors. La, 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 la.
Carefully chosen artwork that evokes.
Oh, shit. That just completely, it just fools all the silly robots. Look at the pretty picture. Oh, it all must be true. Look at the pretty picture.
Themes or the ideas in the narrative. So, yeah, so thanks for calling that out.
Yeah, so is it always an exciting time in astronomy and astrophysics, or have there been periods of stagnation analogous to those?
Analogous to right now, where even though they spend $10 billion on a telescope, it's all really boring smarting. You know, $10 billion, and oh yeah, the picture's a little more in focus. But it's the same damn picture, isn't it? We've already been there and done that, haven't we? Yes. Fuck.
It was in physics. I get the sense that in physics, certainly, you know, in any given generation, there's an impressive feeling of, you know, at least on the theory side, of spinning your...
They just made it all fucking up. That's the, you know, the real narrative is, you know, for 100 years they've been lost in a loop of bullshit. And it's all bullshit, okay? Entanglement, singularities, this black hole, it's all bullshit. Holograms, multi-dimensional, it's just all bullshit.
Wheels and not necessarily making discernible progress, but I just intuitively, it seems like it could be different in astronomy and astrophysics.
Yes, I mean, we found the giant duck galaxy, you know, and it's actually quacking and, you know, wobbling through space on its, you know, stupid feet, and it's the duck galaxy, and it's just so exciting. Where will it go? The only downside is it's only moving a fourth of a millimeter per 500 years, so we're not going to know the answer of where it's going for a very long time. Yeah, way after tomorrow.
they're...
That's a perceptive point, and let me attempt to address it, whether or not I fully...
Oh, well, let's see if I can insult my colleagues and make everybody else seem irrelevant. We still have a great show we do at the New York Planetarium. Yes, it's a great show. We have laser beams and all kinds of stuff to simulate reality. And it's just so much fun, and all the kids go, ooh, hello, and ooh, it's just fun. But yes, the rest of astrology is just that, a bunch of nothing. Boring.
Answer it. In physics, what you're referring to, I think, is sort of the revolution or evolution of ideas, mm-hmm. right? And you don't get those every day. You know, you get them maybe once in a generation.
Yes, and you haven't gotten any for 100 years. You haven't really figured out anything new in 100 years that's real. Okay, they just figured out a bunch of fake stuff. You know, stuff that isn't really happening. That, you know, there's never going to be a quantum computer. There's none of this crap has any reality. It's just all just bullshit. All right, a gravitational wave is never going to quack like a duck and do anything. No, it's never going to happen. It's not a real thing.
And all the years in between are filling in the gaps between those ideas. And those don't tend to get headlines, even if they're intrinsically exciting to a physicist. So in astrophysics, occasionally ideas matter deeply, yes. But what happens...
No, this story is even more boring because all we have to work with really is, it's just balls of shit flying around in space and it gets caught in these thingies and they tend to go flat because, you know, the gravity pulls them flat and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's very uninteresting. And it takes trillions of years for anything to happen.
More frequently is that weird stuff gets discovered, right? Or interesting stuff. Water on the moon, on the craters of the moon. A black...
Wow, it's so exciting. There's 49 ounces of water on the moon. Phew. Who knew?
Coal in the galaxy, in the center of the galaxy. Photograph of the black hole in the center of the galaxy.
They don't have a photograph of the black hole in the center of the galaxy. So again, another lie. It's not a photograph. You don't take a photograph, from bits of data over months from different locations. That's not what a photograph is.
So things that exist in the universe, because the universe is so vast and it has so many different kinds of objects.
It really doesn't have that many different kinds. See, that's the whole thing. All of the things are doing pretty much the same thing. On fire, not on fire. Yes, pretty much all there is.
All of our catalogs, we probably missed something that is one in a million or even one in a billion. And when that gets discovered, that's headlines. And
so it's just such bullshit because it really isn't doing any of this stuff. There's very few little objects in this whole thing of objects that are actually doing something profoundly interesting besides just being obedient to gravity. Very, very little.
So no, it doesn't rethink the whole field.
I mean, every now and then there's one of these things blows up, and that's about the only thing interesting that ever happens is the blowing up part. The dying. Something dies, okay, and it's fun to watch them die. that kind of thing, but that's it.
But it is definitely fun to inventory and talk about and characterize.
Oh, shit. I just don't know who it's fun to. I mean, I just couldn't care less. I mean, compared to the, analyzing the biology around us and, the microscopic stuff, this stuff is incredibly boring. I mean, what you can see under a microscope is, many times more, hey, there's shit happening, than out there.
And try to figure it out. Now, I did do one thing. For a while, I was a postdoc at Princeton, and Princeton has our feature journal, the Astrophysical Journal, all on one wall, okay? From its very first episode, for its very first issue, 1895, the Astrophysical Journal, up to the present. And I thought to myself, let me do this experiment. And I found the exact middle of that wall of all the journals. And I said, I wonder what date this is. And it was...
5 years ago.
So this would be sort of the halfway point. And as I did this, and I kept having it, what I found is that the halfway interval of time was 18 years. It fluctuated between 15 and 18 years. So... the total amount that was published doubled every 15. Now, not all of it is quality. You get that. I understand. But as a first pass measure of the pace of things, this was highly illuminating to me. And it said that, yeah, I mean, if you're living on the exponential curve, every day looks like you're living in special times. And I remember going back, I have a book on the sun written by an astronomer named Charles Young. In fact, he was at Princeton in his day. I have two versions of the book. One that came out in like 18.
Fuck, sorry. Yeah, I just, I thought this was going to be a little bit interesting. So far, just terrible, awful, crappy shit. All right, so let's jump a little bit ahead. I hate to do it. We might miss the good bit.
At this point, how many extra solar planets have been cataloged?
Over 4,000, yeah, and it's rising fast.
Yeah. And so I mean, what's the safe assumption now?
So this whole obsession with, well, we found a planet. So what? We found 9 of them here, and they're all kind of not very interesting.
That our own galaxy has hundreds of billions of planets? I mean, what's the...
Yeah, so we do that calculation, and you, in the section, are we alone in the universe? But you can ask a different set of philosophical questions, something that might titillate you. You can look at all of the layers of bias that are inherent in how we even go about answering those questions.
Because good, yes, that's right. It's all bias. The Drake equation, the whole concept of asking the question, how likely is it, when we have absolutely no idea. We have no reference, no context in which to say, how hard is it? Somebody's not handing you a set of dice that has, 5 sides or whatever, 6 sides, and you have numbers on them and you're going to count. You can't do any of that. There's no reference for the improbability of almost every bit of our biology. Every piece of the evolution of our biology is an unknown variable. I mean, it's really not just what's the odds of... you can have more than one outcome kind of thing. Some things only have 3 outcomes. Some things have 15 outcomes. Clearly, when you're talking about things evolving, there's trillions of possible ways it could, an event can take place. And so you're saying oil doesn't mix with water. Well, I guess it does if the water is just the right temperature and the oil is just the right temperature, that kind of thing.
Because even in your very statement, you said, well, how many planets? Because the life that you know and the life that I know lives on a planet. Hmm. But maybe life also lives on moons. Maybe it lives in atmosphere. Maybe it lives in gas clouds.
All right. So there's sort of some recognition that you can understand that it can't live where there's not energy. Okay. So it can't evolve. It can't be created in any places that don't have a certain... You have to have some capacity... It's like you're rolling the dice. You can't roll the dice into a tiny, tiny structure that only allows the dice to go in once at a time. And it only, you're going to limit the capacity of variance by eliminating all the sides for the dice to bounce off of, that kind of thing. And obviously those tiny... So there's places in the universe where, there's just not enough permutations and not enough rolls of the dice for you to have any hope of doing anything complicated. Or, like I said, some of it's just physically impossible. If the dice are in too narrow a space, then the dice couldn't land on top of each other. And what if the outcome requires the dice to land on top of each other? Well, that's not possible in certain locations. All right, I'm back. Yeah, I took a nap. No.
So we go through all of the biases. There's a carbon bias, right? We are carbon-based life. Some of these biases, I think, are fully legitimate. But if you really want to search with as wide a net as possible, also consider the Goldilocks zone. So much was written and talked about for decades, from the 1950s and 60s, when this concept was...
All right, whatever. So this all has to do with, it has to be a liquid, it has to be chemically active. So the fact is that water is a solvent. It does break chemistry down, and so you end up with a bunch of elements swooshing around and a bunch of compounds. It also allows for stuff to combine in the liquid. So, I mean, there's properties of water that make it more conducive than other substances that might be a liquid. Other liquids aren't conducive to the recombination of chemistry, diverse chemistry. So, so some of that does have legitimacy. So this is, like I said, this is his hypocrisy. You probably go back 10 years and you can find him talking about how, the plant does have to be in this Goldilocks zone. And so now he's saying, nah, it's not so important. Yeah, it's probably pretty important, frankly. But whatever.
It's first formulated where we know life needs and thrives on liquid water. So if you're going to stick a planet in a star system, not too close, it'll evaporate the water. Not too far, it will freeze the water. So there's this zone, this belt around any star where a planet would naturally have liquid water. And you need atmospheric conditions to sustain it, of course, but you're not fighting it. It would happen naturally if the conditions allow. And so then we learn, wait a minute, the sun is not the only source of energy in town. All right, Jupiter and its tidal stresses on its surrounding moons is a source of energy. So one of Jupiter's moons, Io, is the most volcanically active place in the entire solar system because Jupiter is pumping it with energy. And so now we have to think, if life needs the warming energy of it just needs an energy source, why does it have
to? why do it the hard way when you can do it the easy way? So that would be the simple argument. I mean, obviously volcanic energy, heating, who knows where the heat actually comes from, right? It's all gravitational is the point. You're moving this stuff, that's why there's gravity, is because you're moving matter. But whatever. So what's the difference? So then you're just making the argument that, life starts underwater in a volcanic vent. So what? I mean, whether it happens because of ionizing radiation from the sun on the surface, or whether it happens because you've got a warm environment and a bunch of chemistry, who cares?
To have a star. And so you just go on, and then we learn every model of the solar system that we construct, that of any star system when it's born, most of the planets that formed are on unstable orbits and they fly out into interstellar space. It may be that there are more vagabond planets than there are planets bound to their local star systems. So you say, well, that's not a good prospect for life. However, Earth still has energy sources in its core.
Yeah.
This is how you get volcanoes and all these mid-sea.
Okay, obviously when you're threw out into space, isn't going to have any of that activity. It's going to get very cold very fast. So none of that's going to happen. So if it's not caught up orbiting in a system where it's getting pulled apart in different directions, then yes, it's not going to be a very hot planet.
Events that are pumping very hot waters into the bottoms of the oceans. If you're a life form thriving on that, you don't even care if you were ever orbiting a sun. You could be a frozen lake bed, a frozen...
So again, he's making an argument that is completely dependent on orbiting. So you can't have any of that internal heat or crustal heat or whatever he's talking about. You can't have any of that volcanic energy, lava, molten, unless you're in a gravitational field. So again, he's, screwing up the argument.
Ice on top, but down below, you could be doing the backstroke in your warmed hot tub. So this notion that we want to look for planets and look for a habitable zone, a Goldilocks zone, may be needlessly restrictive as we go forward.
So he is. He did just actually argue against the very thing he argued for 10 years ago.
So now how have your intuitions been pushed around with respect to the prospect that we are alone versus the prospect, seemingly equally astonishing, that the galaxy and the universe is teeming with life? Have you had changes in the way you weight those?
Sorry, this one really comes down to is just how improbable you think the evolutionary process is, because in a sense you could argue, given enough time of organisms evolving, that it seems quite sensible that they would follow a pattern. So they follow a pattern, like marsupials ended up duplicating, or you could say mammals duplicate marsupials, it doesn't really matter, of predators and prey that tended to look like each other. Okay, I mean the South American cheetahs are in Africa. I just hate this shit. you know, this getting, you know, brain artifacts, you know, crap, dirt, whatever it is that happens to over time. Jaguar. So the Jaguar, you know, even though it's not a, you know, it's not a completely different lineage, it looks a lot like a leopard, but it's, you know, their common relative is some kind of frog, you know, that kind of thing. So they evolved to fill a niche, and they filled it the same way, you know, duplicating, you know, many of the same physical features, is the argument. All right, how to say, so yeah, so the patterns are pretty built in, and you would argue that the pattern of acquiring a brain, okay, would be something that things would evolve into, a control structure. You know, making the leap of a brain that can think outside of the programming is a whole other subject, and the idea of creating a feeling and all of that, and whether that's necessary to thinking, you know, I would argue that it sort of is, because you need the reward punishment idea to have useful intelligence. I mean, intelligence doesn't, you know, where you can learn outside, you don't have to learn before you start. So if you had to be pre-programmed with all knowledge, that's too much work. Yeah, making all of that code and putting it into something is just not likely.
Probabilities over the course of your life?
Yeah, that's a great way to ask that question. I would say the probabilities have, as they've changed only because we learned new things, but not because I had to reevaluate what I was already thinking.
Oh, well, of course, you learn new things, and then that's called reevaluating. When you learn something new, you have to recompile the equation. So it's just...
I've always been very open to possibilities of the universe, just given the size and the diversity of objects and the age. You know, practically anything you can imagine being possible, we think is going to be possible. But there's some other really good reasons for some of the bias that we are invoking here. For example, there's a famous episode of the original Star Trek where they encounter a life form that's basically made of rock. And it moves through rock like we move through air. And it's rock-based life. And an active ingredient in a lot of minerals is silicon. So it's silicon-based life. And this was their attempt to do this in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And this was silicon-based life as opposed to carbon-based life. Well, they didn't pull silicon out of their ass, right?
So this is just another one of these archaic arguments about what you base, what compound or what substance you make it out of. Who cares? I mean, it's just, it's not terribly interesting, but obviously silicon is not exactly like carbon. You can make lots of compounds, but it's still not carbon. Let's see, what else can you say about it? It just doesn't matter. That's really not the point. The point is what's the odds of creating something that can start evolution? So you have to make this DNA molecule thing. And is there any way to create a silicon-based DNA molecule would be the question. Can you use silicon-based compounds to make the protein that you can, you know, create some sort of genetic... You know, I don't know how what to analogize it for. I mean, you really need to do the evolution thing. You need something else that's evolving. So we're not evolving. You're not making this. You're making the code. The code is, you know, takes up a tiny amount of space, and you can do lots and lots of coding experiments in a tiny amount of space and in a tiny amount of time. Where if you have to keep making these big giant things, you're not going to evolve very fast. So it's really just about code evolution. And can you make another variety of molecule that duplicates itself? Because that's really what evolution is about.
Why do people think of silicon-based life? If you go back to the periodic table and remember why elements form columns, the columns have similar valence electrons, which means if you're above or below another element in a table, in the periodic table, you can make similar molecules with all the same other atoms. Mm. Well, let's find carbon. Well, there it is at the top of the chart, number 12. What's directly below it? Silicon. So every molecule you can make with carbon, you can make with silicon. So why not create an entire parallel life system where silicon is the base instead of carbon. And so that's a perfectly legitimate chemical broadening of your bias as you go search. My rebuttal to that is you don't need to do that because first, carbon is hugely sticky. Mm-hmm. It sticks to itself and multiple bonds and silicon also. But what you really win out is that carbon, depending on where exactly you are in the universe, is between 5 and 10 times as abundant. So carbon is already...
yeah, well, so what if there's a trillions of it, who cares if one thing's more abundant than another thing? I mean, apparently Earth is made out of more aluminum than it is iron. Who cares?
You're going to be at it before silicon, you know, figures out how to put on its pants in the morning. And so I don't need to really think of life forms based on an isotope of bismuth or even silicon. So I think carbon is the way to go here, just given its diversity of chemistry.
Okay, so, but my another point to the question would be is how much of it is accessible? That is, how fast does it get combined into something else that can't go anywhere? So how fast does it become inert? You know, so that could be another question in the sense of, you know, some stuff is so reactive that it reacts and it stays, like carbon gets sunk. You know, it's a real subject. So carbon is sinkable. Maybe silicon wouldn't be as sunkable.
That it offers us. And I don't know if I directly answered your question. Oh, have I changed any of my evaluations?
Yeah.
So the Fermi paradox is what you're dancing around there. And I want to clarify the Fermi paradox because I think most people who invoke it don't know.
All right. So, yeah. So when I first heard the Fermi paradox, the argument is just this, you know, it's kind of just a simple one. Okay. If there were civilizations that had billions of years head start on us, okay, wouldn't they be at some point where they're doing all the stuff we just imagine doing, you know, in the future? You know, when they have conquered all of these barriers and, you know, they would be making lighthouses, so to speak, in space, just saying, we're here. They'd be doing all this kind of stuff with technology and all this kind of crap. And, you know, so it sort of makes the argument that there's obviously not a time machine, you know, because somebody would have showed up and done the time machine thing. And we'd all have stories of, hey, that, you know, in 1923, the guy from the future showed up and changed things. I mean, we'd have that story. So it isn't happening. So the if there is intelligence in the universe, it's clearly not in any kind of state where it's doing anything very loud or interesting.
The full weight that it carries. All right, so you can do the thought experiment. So Enrico Fermi, the physicist, famously quipped, if there's life in the galaxy, then the galaxy ought to be teeming with life, and they would have visited us by now. Where are they? Okay? So maybe they're not there at all.
It might be worth spelling out why that seems so logical. I mean, just with respect to any kind of time
window
in which...
Exactly. Yeah. So you can ask yourself, well, how wide is the galaxy? So 100,000 light years. Okay. So that feels intractable. So let's say you never get...
All right. So the argument would be is that, okay, the galaxy is big, full of shit, lots of stuff. So even that small universe is a big universe, and there's and that one can communicate. I mean, you can hear things. The other, you know, passengers are making. They're close enough where you can hear what's going on in their cabin, so to speak. And so, if there were intelligence in our galaxy, it would be close enough that we would know about it.
To the speed of light, but let's say we get to 20% the speed of light. That means you can cross the galaxy in 500,000 years. All right. But most stars are not the diameter of the galaxy away from each other. They're much nearer. So, for example, Alpha Centauri system from Earth, 4 light years away, 20% the speed of light, you get there in 20 years. Okay? And you can star hop. So imagine, this is one of those, I forgot whose machine they got named after. You go to a planet, and then it's with a robot, and then the robot builds 2 copies of itself, and then they launch to other planets. Okay.
So this isn't Fermi's argument. So I like that. I like where this is going just because, yeah, I've had the same idea. Let's make a robot, okay, that reproduces itself. It goes to another planet. It picks up the resources, the minerals, and it makes a copy of itself. And let's say its agenda is to go into the universe and just kill anything that looks like it's a little bit alive. Great idea.
And so, or even people, or aliens. So they arrive on a planet, and then they say, okay, time to go to more planets. And now you go from one planet to two to four to eight, to star systems. It turns out, if you did that, only going to two once you land on one, you can, it's two to the n power, right? So however many years are loaded in your n.
Right, so it just says, let's say it takes 10 years to make a copy. All right, you have hundreds of thousands, even millions of years to do this. So you're making a copy in every 10 years. You could obviously understand that, well, shit, that would end up being a lot of copies after 100,000 years. An insane number. And that, yes, you would colonize the whole galaxy, you know, in the time it takes to traverse it, pretty much.
You can easily completely populate the entire galaxy in an evolutionary timescale. Mm. Easily.
Yeah.
And so, like, you can do it within a few, like, you know, tens of millions.
Yes, tens of millions, not billions.
Billions of years. And but the planet is around for billions of years. So where is everybody? That's the question. And
the other intuition, the other element to this picture is that
so it's not just about aliens visiting. It's about aliens making technology that would have visited. Okay, so yeah, we would send drones first. We would send robots. We would send machines. And so it's just another way of sending something. I mean, the first thing we're going to send is noise, but you know, noise isn't very durable over distance. The second wave would be actual physical material, cannonballs that remake themselves and keep flying, you know, that kind of thing.
Complex life is ubiquitous. You would expect certain civilizations to be millions of years ahead of us. I mean, because given, you know, nearly 14 billion years to start this experiment, it would just be a miracle if all complex life were at precisely the same point in its technological evolution. So to find ourselves not surrounded by evidence of technological alien life is to suggest that it might not exist because, you know, again, where is everybody?
Yeah, and you're right. We are very Johnny-come-latelys in this.
Yeah, and there's no real evidence that the time scale is as short as they're making it, the 13 billion years, right? I mean, these numbers are doubling every 10 years, too. So, you know, that prediction is kind of lame.
You have the 14 billion year old age of the universe. Then you have the 4.5 billion year old solar system. And then ask, you know, how old is the branch of the tree of life called primates, right? If primates were your best chance, or mammals, let's say, were your best chance of, quote, intelligence on Earth, we really didn't get underway until after the dinosaurs. And that's basically yesterday, 65 million years ago. And the Earth had been around for hundreds of millions of years cranking out life. So imagine a planetary system that got a billion year head start on us.
Yeah.
If there's any forcing vector towards intelligence, we would be dwarfed by any such intelligence that manifested itself. And the comparison I like making, and I'll get back to Fermi in just a moment.
So again, that's the other, I think, more interesting question is, can you dwarf something's intelligence? I mean, is there a point where you don't go any further than 2 + 2 = 4? I mean, is there really something else to know? I guess would be the argument. Is there any math that needs to be known beyond knowing how to do math? Let's just argue. So are there any questions that you need more intelligence to answer? Are there any, where does intelligence have to go except I can calculate that faster? Well, so what? You know, where it's not this test isn't about how fast you can answer a question, it's about how well you can answer a question. So the whole idea of exponential intelligence is just ridiculous, in my opinion. There's only a certain number of interesting questions, and there's going to be a level of knowledge of how the game works, and I'm just saying we already have all of that information. The universe is just making robots, and we just happen to be a variety of the robot that's created. And we have the pretense that we're collecting information and doing this and doing that, and we're really not doing anything. We're, most of it's just bullshit. We're not really processing the truth. People are just processing their fairy tales. Made-up crap. And if you process the truth, you'll just figure out all we do here is make a mess and then partially clean it up. We don't solve a problem the universe has. We don't make it work better. And all we do is torture feeling things to redundantly play out a soap opera.
Is this comparison you always hear about the DNA between the chimp, bonobo, let's say, and a human? You know, it's some high 90, 99, whatever percent, identical DNA. And the people who want to keep thinking humans are special will say, but what a difference that half a percent makes. And they crowd themselves into that half a percent and celebrate all that we are.
Right. You know, this is sort of an interesting question from, you know, I think, in terms of you can go into kind of why humans are intelligent. They keep making this argument, it has to do with our brain size. And, you know, how much sense does that really make to you? I mean, you know, there's small people on Earth, you know, and they have smaller brains. That smaller brain doesn't work less well. So it's really not about size. It's about something else. So you could argue it's about the number of neurons in the brain. Okay. That sort of makes sense. You need a certain number. But I would argue that the feature that makes the difference is just look at a human baby. It's completely dysfunctional. Can't do a damn thing. Completely unsurvivable. So it has a long gestation time, and it doesn't come out more well-formed than other primates. Comes out less well-formed. So something else is going on. It's not about the brain size. It's about the fact that there's something going on differently in its brain that's going to make it language capable, and that's the real difference. And so all the other organisms have to be ready to perform on Earth. That means they have to have a lot of instinctive programming, and humans don't. And that means you have a whole bunch of space available for learning language, where chimpanzees have to use that space to be able to climb and do different things quickly. They have to learn how to be competent very fast, physically competent, where a human doesn't have to be physically competent for years. You know, it's a huge advantage in terms of leaving the space open for receiving the new programming, where the chimpanzee is still stuck with the old programming. And that's the difference. So you just can't teach them a language. And without language, you're not going to get smart. Get smart. Anyway, take a little break. I probably should jump ahead and such.
Start that chimps are not. But I'd rather pose the question a little differently and say, suppose the difference between humans and chimps is as small as a half a percent DNA in the intelligence vector, whatever that vector is. Suppose it is that small. What do you say? Well, what do you mean? We have the Hubble telescope and poetry and philosophy, and they stick a twig in a hole to get termites out. And I say, well, maybe the difference between those is...
Right. So, look, obviously, if we didn't get educated, if we weren't educatable, all right, then we'd be sticking, you know, we could only learn by seeing. We could only learn stupid things. We couldn't do any of this abstract thinking, all of that kind of crap. So if you just take away all of your education, okay, that had anything to do with language, and everything had to be shown to you, okay, yes, you're not going to be very smart, all right, and that's the real disadvantage. So the fact is, if we, you know, I think if we could slow the maturation of a chimpanzee down, that is, make it gestate slower, and, you know, we could slow down the process, you know, so we could do that, put in a better operating system that is capable of holding the 1,000 words or so that you need. I mean, this, you know, I've already gone into it, but, you know, Helen Keller was a very good example of the fact that it's just all about, language is about having all the words. And if you don't have enough words, it doesn't work at all. So there was this whole point in teaching Helen Keller where you taught her and she learned how, you know, how to make the right symbol. but she didn't understand that the symbols were actually representing objects in the world. So she didn't understand it was a language. She just thought it was some sort of trick you do. Like, I have to go to the bathroom. You could do simple things. And that's what it meant. It had an outcome. But she didn't understand that what was actually being stated, okay, that the symbols were actual things in the environment. And, well, anyway, and so there was the key point where she realized that the sign for water meant water, and that the sign for tree was a tree, and that these were things in the environment. And that's when it clicked. And she said, I can now talk because I understand what the words are, that hippopotamus isn't an abstraction. It's an object. Well, anyway. And so that's all we've been able to do is they had Coco the gorilla, but the truth is Coco really didn't understand it was language. And so it was just mimicking, you know. And yeah, you can do something with mimicking, but you really can't have a conversation till you understand that it's language, that their words actually represent objects and actions.
Small. You don't want to think that way, but imagine it. So now let's imagine an alien who is 5% along that same vector beyond us that we are beyond the chimp. What would we look like to them? No reason for me to think that we wouldn't look any different to them that chimps look to us.
Okay, so that's just silly baby talk, right? So again, that has to do with some sort of like exponential growth in intelligence, and there's just no way to make that logically sensible. It's just the capacity to do logic and reasoning. We have vocabulary. We have reached having an understanding. So that's a huge difference between a chimpanzee who doesn't have any language and us that has rather substantial language, and we haven't optimized it. We have a bunch of woo words in our vocabulary, but I just mean it's there. So we can do the addition, we can do the multiplication, we can do the division. These are all the key elements of doing the mathematics. So there's nowhere it goes except, yes, you can do more and more complex math, but what the hell, how is that more intelligent? It's besides it just being more time consuming. So you can spend more time thinking, but you can't really do better thinking once you have logic in place. So I'm sure there are, more intelligent people are less likely to believe in flat earth or God or something stupid. So yes, they'll have less garbage in their understanding. But will they really have any, is there really any source of information that's critically or substantially better than the information we're gleaning? I mean, I'm not saying there's nothing to see with a better telescope, but in a sense, there really isn't that much more to see.
Because a smart chimp can stack boxes and reach a banana. Toddlers can do that. So what does a smart human do? Well, we can, roll Stephen Hawking forward. Here's a smart human. And they'll chuckle and say, oh, he derives black hole theories in his brain, just like little Timmy over here who just came home from preschool. So, and that's a 0.5%. So now imagine 5%, 10%. And their simplest...
So again, this whole argument that somehow Stephen Hawking had some access to some sort of useful, better knowledge is just bullshit. So, they were substantially or meaningfully more intelligent than other people in any kind of, by a fair contest. He wasn't winning the race by much. I mean, he had a little bit more book learning, and that's about it.
Expression of an idea would transcend our smartest capacity to comprehend. In the same way you walk up to a chimp and say...
This is just bullshit. Sorry. It's just about having the capacity to reason. And then you say, do logic. Combine facts in a rational manner. And that's all we can do. And that's all some super intelligence can do is combine the facts that exist in a rational manner. And there's only so many facts. There's only so many pieces of information that have any utility. And those questions are going to be, well, how old is the universe now? This and that, they're not all that interesting. And, the real interesting part is understanding we evolved on planet Earth and we're basically just another bug. Okay, it's a bug planet, and we're handy capable on the bug planet. Okay, we're still, you know, we're bugs that have a big giant ego and think we're so much better than a bug when, you know, if you really look at what we do, we're just parasitic and, you know, exploitants, and, you know, it's all bugs. It's all bug behavior. And so that's all is super intelligence is also going to realize that these competitive bots, you know, these bots built by a system that forces the bots to trick each other and entrap each other and defeat each other, are just going to be kind of malicious robots.
What time is it? They have no idea what you're talking. You know, want a cup of coffee at a Starbucks? Going to catch a plane? Do you want to go to the library? None of this makes any sense to them, and they're our simplest sentences. So I think about this all the time, leaving me to wonder whether the search for intelligent life, SETI, is itself a bit of hubris. Mm-hmm. Because it assumes that some other species has our intelligence, and not something so far beyond us that they would take.
Okay, so again, what would be beyond us? Again, it's all there is to do here is to do the math. Just add up the facts. Just add up the two-ness plus the two-ness and get four-ness. Get, you know, find the cruel thing, find the inefficient thing, find the inefficient motor, and put oil on it. Find the thing that's broken or in, you know, doesn't function properly and fix it. I mean, there's not much else to do. There's nothing else that intelligence says do. All right. Yes, your hormones can tell you to do something, but your intelligence is just here to fix and make things more efficient. Is to put, you know, is to obviously just problem solution. Problem solution. Problem solution. Problem solution. What else is there for intelligence to do but fix things? There's no other sensible agenda but to find out what's valuable and make more of it. You know, make more good stuff than bad stuff. Prevent bad things, facilitate good things. So just finding out what's good and what's bad. Is there something else to do? No. Is there some other more important question? No. So there's obviously no exponential growth in your capacity to evaluate those questions. Having 5 million times more calculating capacity is not going to make it any easier for you to answer the question, how much torture is worth how much pleasure? It's just not going to help. All right, let's jump ahead a little bit. Okay, let's wait for YouTube to do that. Yeah. Come on. Play. Please come on. I didn't jump.
So initially they have their own territory, but then they encounter each other. And then the entire system implodes because they...
Okay, so that's competition thing. So yes, first you're competing with the other organisms that exist, and then you're also competing with the other sperm, the other, you know, the other... success attempters, and there's no real rules to play in the game except winning. It's not about playing a good game, it's just about getting to the winning circle, winner's circle. And so that makes us corrosive to our own agenda, because our evolution tends to go in sideways or negative directions. Because the fact is, we're not being judged by a system that can evaluate with what integrity you won your medal. It's not going to disqualify you for using steroids. You know, it's not going to disqualify you for injecting, you know, your 5-year-old kid, grinding him up and injecting him into your kidneys or something. Yeah, you're not going to get disqualified.
That's still pretty fast. It's small compared to the life expectancy of Earth. But it's even better than that. Again, I'm value judging the speed of this. Because the early Earth was subjected to what we call the period of heavy bombardment. There were two such periods. Heavy bombardment, Earth is still, the polite way to say it, is accreting matter from the nascent solar system. the more violent way to...
Yeah, it's really a long time ago, though, and it's probably before anything like life happened, so blah, 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 blah. But go ahead, tell your story.
But it is being slammed constantly by comets and asteroids because it has a strong gravity in its region. It's clearing out its orbit, and all that material ends up going somewhere, and it lands back on Earth. And so the Earth is...
All right, so this, look, this all gets to a pretty simple evolutionary argument where you can understand that the evolution of the early organisms went through violent change, okay, in the sense that the first life fed on a certain chemistry, and then the next version essentially fed on everything opposite that. So all of the waste products it started eating, okay? So it started breathing shit and shitting oxygen, you know, that kind of thing. It was exactly the opposite. So the things that were eating the first life form's residue became the next version of life on Earth. Okay, it's the same, made of the same DNA structure, but it just reconfigures to capitalize on the new environment, which is the filth created by the first version that didn't stop replicating. So it's like the little replicating robot in space. Obviously, if you play that out over time, the planets get all eaten up and there's no planets left and there's just robots, okay? So there's just, you know, all the minerals get turned into robots eventually. And so then what can happen, you know? Nothing. So one of the robots evolves to eat the other robots. Well, then that's a big, you know, he's got lots of food then for an awful long time. So, yeah, life went through all those transitions before it got onto a stable environment. Okay, that was stable both environmentally. The external universe wasn't being too radical in the fluctuations. You know, we weren't switching our magnetic poles too often or any of that kind of crap. And it also got more stable in the sense that there were so many competing players now that one species couldn't control the environment because the more of you there was, the more likely you would become a food source. So everything had to kind of try not to be too successful, because if you became too successful, everything else would say, hey, it'd be a good idea to make that food. If we can eat that shit, there's lots of that shit, so let's go eat it. Because there's like an endless supply of it. Yeah. So anything that adapted to be able to eat the successful stuff had a very good prospect for the future. So you're a target, is the point. I mean, funguses are one of the most durable, easy to make, easy to breed, all that kind of stuff, but they're not very prolific, because if they did become, I would argue that the evolution's already taught fungus that you don't want to be too successful, because if you're too successful, you'll get exterminated.
It's gaining mass, and by gaining mass, it gains even more gravity, it becomes even better at it, and over that time, Earth's surface is sufficiently pelted that the temperatures prevent the formation of complex molecules. Because under high temperatures, the molecular bonds break.
Right. So you can't have any bonds with too little energy, and you can't maintain anything chemically sophisticated if there's too much. So too little's no good, too much no good. Duh, who cares? All right. We're all the way back to that argument. All right, I'll jump ahead a little.
To make huts, that was available. Then we used trees. That's pretty convenient. Then we found metal. Oh my gosh, let's use that, okay? And then we learned how to make alloys. Let's do that. And then we learned chemistry. Let's do that.
Yeah, and then we learned that, oh shit, the whole thing is futile and stupid and redundant. I mean, we're just, you know, writing little personal silly adventure stories, and they all don't end happily ever after. And it's all for nothing. We're just redundantly doing the same crappy play over and over and over. And it's not a beautiful symphony. It's just a noisy, sloppy, ugly, yuck. Don't do it over and over again.
So what's another 65 on top of the 300? They'd still be here. So what this tells us is what we think of as intelligence clearly is not important for survival. Otherwise, roaches would have really big brains. right? So maybe the big mistake.
Yeah, well, whatever. So survival isn't what the, you know, obviously the story isn't about survival. It's about conquest. So, you know, and there is a whole big universe to conquest. So the, yes, life started in the ocean, let's say, and it migrated onto the surface of the Earth. The ocean didn't do any big smart stuff. The Earth did do smart stuff, and it's smart stuff that can now go to other planets. Okay, nothing in the ocean is going to build a ship and go to another planet, but yes, the stuff on the ground could do that. Well, we sort of have a little bit done that.
So those cities, so they can stand out as beautifully as they do. Mm. But if you're going to go 250,000 miles away from them and stand on the moon, you become much less visible. And that's our nearest neighbor in space. And allow me to quantify this. Imagine a schoolroom globe. And I'm always sad because there's always color coded. And so you think of Earth as a place divided by countries, not unified by land and water and atmosphere. That's just me getting sentimentally cosmic on it. But you can ask, well, at what altitude above that globe would you find the International Space Station? Half the people I've asked that come away about a foot from it. It's about a, no, it's 3/8 of an inch mm-hmm. above the surface. All right, now where would the moon be? Well, we're so jaded by how often we see the Earth and moon drawn in a textbook, people tend to put the moon maybe a foot or two away. No, the moon is 30 feet away.
30 feet, now I wouldn't have guessed that. So if the Earth is the size of a globe, he's saying, no, so it's this size. He's saying the moon is 30 feet away. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't think it was that far. I mean, it's only a couple 100,000 miles. You know, how could it be? How could it be? Does that come up to 30 feet? Let's see. So the Earth is like 4,000 miles diameter. Yeah, so 4,000 into, you know, 200,000. Okay, I guess it comes out to be something like that. All right, never mind.
Where would Mars be? A mile away. Space is vast. So to directly image a planet. Yes, that could be on our horizon, but to image it in a way where we're going to see roads and cities, I think that's unrealistic. But I say that, but smiling because I know what we're already up to, right? You want to see life forms waving back at you. What I want to see is any evidence in the atmosphere that anybody's alive on that planet's surface.
Yeah.
And these are, we call them collectively biomarkers. Right.
So, all right, so I don't know, biomarkers. I think you have a more likely prospect that you'll hear nuclear tests or some other kind of thing. But yeah, who knows? Who knows how far, you know, how little you can detect over what distance? I mean, how much of the energy is still coherent enough that, you know, if you took an hour and listened, but you really can't take an hour to listen to like a TV show or something. You're not going to be able to put that back together. So yeah, well, who cares? Whatever. I don't think that's the more important question. Isn't so much. Again, I mean, people want to say, okay, let's say there was. It wasn't as. I would argue that there's so many. The simplest argument I can make is, our planet is covered with parts. Okay, so it's like you could think of it as a junkyard and it's car parts. And the whole surface is just covered with headlights, taillights, all kinds of crap. You know, fenders, steering wheels, motors, all the parts you could possibly want to make cars, to make living things, to make a new form of life even. All the parts you need. So you don't have to make the headlight and you don't have to make the fender. You can just pick out the parts. And even on this planet, it doesn't happen. There's no aliens on Earth. Okay, so you have all the parts you could possibly want. You have more chemistry on this planet than any place you could accept some other planet occupied by smart enough beings to make chemistry, right? So we've taken natural chemistry's maximum diversity and we've, you know, magnified it even further in terms of littering the planet with our pollution. And, you know, which is a bunch of compounds. And even in that environment, there's no niche, there's no place, there's no nothing where anything does it any different than that first living thing. And there's no, you know, and then you can look at all of the biology of human beings. There's nothing that thinks with something other than a neuron. So all the brains that do anything called thinking have to have a neuron. Okay, so why isn't there some life form that thinks with something other than a neuron? Why is it always all based on neurons? So you're going to have to say, gee, that's all one event thing. There wasn't two events. There wasn't even a second kind of cell, you know, a biological or organism-based cell that does thinking. There's not even a structure. There's nothing. There's nothing that shows that you can make a brain out of something else. And it hasn't happened on this planet. Nothing. Nothing. There's no competing mechanism. So clearly it's a rare event. All right, anyway. And clearly to make a machine that can do it requires a very small niche of function. Maybe it doesn't have to be electrical. Maybe it doesn't have to be this. Maybe it doesn't have to be that. But clearly there's no version of neuron that's not got a single origin. You know, that's made of Adam and Eve neuron. And that's all there is. All right, anyway. So, I don't know how constructive this video was, but whatever. It's probably worth playing some pop culture stuff. So I'll just say for the sake of argument, so Sam Harris got 388,000 views on this video, but his average, which surprised me, is like 50,000 for his YouTube videos of his podcast. Now, part of that could be that he cuts the videos, you know, doesn't give you the endings, you know, which is kind of yuck. But, you know, whatever, making money kind of thing. Tacky. Whatever. I suppose he should at least make the old ones available in... maybe he does. I don't know. Well, anyway. What am I going to say? So compared to what, you know? I mean, the 40 million views that some video where somebody's putting mints in a Coke bottle... You know, I mean, just, you know, the conversation about the destiny of human intelligence in the current environment is just so bleak. When you consider how few humans are seeking anything in terms of intelligent conversation, and they just want to see soda bottles explode. I mean, they're entertained by such garbage that you're just like, oh, fuck. You know. You know, who can defend humanity when it's, you know, its real character is so low. Okay. So anyway, enough of that. So till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. Strange video, I have to concede. This is a little bit strange. Anyway. Yeah, that's it. Till the next time and such.